From Eye Care Partners, this is the Doc to Doc podcast, clinical discussions with our team of world-class eye care professionals across the country. Through connectedness and continuing education, we help patients see their absolute best for life. Your hosts are Dr. Albert Chung, a cornea and cataract specialist at Virginia Eye Consultants, and Dr. Ian McWhirter, an optometrist at Bennett & Bloom.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Doc to Doc. I'm your co-host, Albert Chung, alongside my co-host, Ian McWhirter. We're excited to have Alex Cohen here, who is a cornea and cataract specialist at Desert Vista Eye Specialist in Phoenix. He'll also be joining our co-hosting team as well. So thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Dr. Cohen, thanks so much for being with us tonight. We appreciate taking the time. You know, we know you're busy writing questions for boards, doing mission work, and even, you know, editor of textbooks. And so really what we're kind of curious about is, doing all that stuff, what kind of techniques have those things taught you to be able to implement into your clinical practice?
Well, thank you guys for having me, number one. You know, I've had the opportunity since about 2015 to work in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland. So traveling there, I've had a lot of exposure to third world medicine. And there we perform manual small incision extracapsular cataract surgery, so M6. And that's, I think, kind of given me the opportunity to see how cataract surgery could be done differently, more than how we're taught here in the U.S. And some things that's really allowed me to understand better and maybe import into my practice are things like, you know, how to use a scleral tunnel in certain situations, or the importance of a Rex's size in certain situations.
We have both optometrists and ophthalmologists as some of our listeners. Could you just kind of give a quick overview of what the manual small incision cataract surgery, you know, kind of entails or is?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if we think back to pre-phaco days, so probably before any of us were involved in this field, so the early 90s, so the guys that trained me, they were doing extracapsular cataract extraction, where they were making a limbal-based incision that was probably between 6 and 8 millimeters, opening up the capsule either with a cystotome or forceps using a can opener technique, and then scooping out the whole lens and removing it in total, and then putting a new lens back in that same space, then suturing those extracapsular incisions closed. And then with the advent of phaco, obviously that allows us to go down to smaller incision size, reduce the amount of astigmatism we are causing, and not have to deal with all those sutures in the postoperative period. Obviously, phaco is pretty expensive. So, you know, looking at the numbers, it probably costs anywhere between $300 and $600 in equipment and supplies to do a phaco. So when you're talking about doing cataract work in the third world, obviously that's a big hurdle. So for about anywhere between $30 to $100, we can do manual small incision cataract surgery. So we get to do a lot more volume.
Wow.
But it's a different technique. We have to know how to do different surgical technique. It's not just saying, well, I do lots of phaco, I can do this surgery. It involves formation of a large contractile pyridomy, followed by a big scleral tunnel. So unlike the extra caps that were done by the guys that taught me, they were based at the limbus. These incisions are stepped back about 2 to 3 millimeters from the limbus. And it's a large scleral tunnel that's wider inside than it is outside. And that allows for these to be self-sealing. The rest of the surgery is pretty similar to what I described earlier, but it's really all about that scleral tunnel so that you can do these quickly and without having to suture them closed. And so that when you leave the OR and leave the country, you don't have a lot of astigmatism to manage and sutures to take out later on.
Well, this is a great technique and one that I actually wish I had more exposure in residency. I think, as you know, we don't get a lot of exposure in residency to this. Did you originally learn this technique abroad, or did you learn it here and then perfect it, or, you know, practice it more abroad? And, you know, when do you use this in your daily practice?
So yeah, like you, I mean, I finished my residency in 2010, and we talked about extra caps. It was like this fabled technique from the old days that we had very minimal exposure to. I think I saw or performed one when I was a resident, and participated in one intracap where we made a massive corneal incision and folded the cornea back with sutures and then used a cryoprobe to take out the lens. But yeah, I mean, we really don't get exposure to these things. So I did my cornea fellowship at University of Iowa, and back then we were doing all of our DSECs through a 5 millimeter scleral tunnel, a superior scleral tunnel. So that gave me that background to be able to at least understand how to make one of those tunnels. And then I was recruited by the guys at Dean McGee Eye Institute, who were doing a lot of mission work in China and Africa. And they asked me to go there and help establish or set up this high volume surgical program. So the plan was for me to fly over there and spend a week and sort of have a mentor who had done 10,000 extra caps or 10,000 M6 and show me how to do them. Plans changed kind of quickly. I showed up and he said, well, I'm getting on a plane in about an hour. So sit down with me, I'll show you how to do one, and I'll watch you do one, and then good luck. So thankfully, I had that training to fall back on where I understood the surgical principle of what we were doing, but definitely the first several days were very difficult in terms of just getting down the technique and, you know, trying to not create complications and do a good job for these patients.
So even though it's a really big scleral incision, no sutures are needed, correct?
Ideally, yeah, you don't use sutures. So if you do this correctly, if you step the incision back from the limbus, unlike the extracaps that were done in the 90s, if you make your scleral tunnel long enough, so about 4 to 5 millimeters, these are actually self-sealing. So the majority that we do there, this will be my sixth trip I'm going on in a few weeks. So I've done maybe, I don't know, 600 cases or something like that, 600 or 700 cases in the past. And I mean, we probably suture like less than 1% of them. You know, if you make your incision well and it's self-sealing, you really don't need sutures for these.
Is this technique something that you would use kind of when you're back home in the States? Like, let's say you're doing a regular phaco cataract and you, some reason you need to convert to this. Like, is this something that the optometrist you're working with would potentially see it during the post-op period for some of these patients?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that's definitely useful to have, you know, to be able to do in this country. When I first got out of my training, I thought, yeah, I can phaco anything, anything's phacoable. You know, you don't really need to do extra caps. And that was just me being a little naive because I didn't really know or understand the technique until I went there and had the experience and exposure to understand what this technique offers patients. So when you have a really, really dense lens, instead of burning through a lot of phaco energy and torching the cornea, you can use this technique and remove the lens without any phaco energy whatsoever. So I've had the experience of doing that here in the U.S. Several times. I mean, just coming back here and feeling comfortable with the technique and seeing patients that might have a really, really dense cataract and saying, you know, perhaps they'd be better off with M6 rather than phaco. Not something I typically recommend if you've never done it before. I wouldn't really say, oh, jump into it and do it on, you know, someone in your private practice or whatever. But if you've had exposure to it or have a mentor that can help you get through the case, I think it's a great technique to have available.
It's also a great rescue technique if you run into an issue. Let's say you needed to convert. Let's say you've already made your main incision with a 2-4 keratome. If you're going to convert to M6, do you go back and go to a different spot to make your M6 wound?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I've thought about that a lot. You know, as you do some tough cases, you think, what if this goes south? How do I do this differently? The M6 incision is obviously very different than your phaco wound because that's clear corneal and M6 is a scleral tunnel. So I guess it depends on where you are in the case, how urgent it is that you should get into the eye and get the lens out. If you've got broken capsule and the lens seems like it's about to fall, you might jump in there and just bring your incision back to the limbus and widen it and scoop out the lens particles. But if you have time and the chamber's stable enough and you want to convert, I would typically either suture my phaco wound or just change positions and sit superiorly if I'm doing a clear corneal temporal phaco. Sit superiorly, start over, take a deep breath, and plan on doing an extra cap through an M6 incision.
Well, that's great. As an optometrist, let's say I'm seeing one of these patients post-op. Is there anything special that I should be looking for on the post-op with somebody who doesn't have sutures and then somebody who does? You know, when do you usually typically take out sutures if there is a suture needed?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, seeing this eye versus seeing a phaco eye, you know, you're used to seeing somewhat edematous corneas, but a small incision and eyes look pretty good overall. These guys, by contrast, are going to have subconjunctival hemorrhage, hyperemia, edema, all that stuff. And it's going to look like the eye got beat up because you made a big conjunctival pleuritomy and made a big scleral tunnel. So definitely you want to communicate as an MD, you want to communicate with people that are helping you manage these patients postoperatively so they understand what was done to the eye and, you know, where the incision's made. And yeah, these people will typically have sutures or they may have sutures, at least in the conjunctiva. And you may choose to suture the sclera as well in certain instances. And you want to, you know, be aware where they are and what to do with them. Typically, if the sutures are done correctly, they're not going to induce a lot of astigmatism. And the knots are rotated posteriorly or buried in the sclera. So they actually don't need to be touched. And you can leave them there forever. But if you see the patient, it's been 1, 2, 3 months or something like that, and they've got a ton of astigmatism and it makes sense that it's those sutures. What I've done in the past is just use, you know, the techniques from glaucoma, from trabeculectomy, and just do laser suture lysis.
Okay.
Cut those stitches and, you know, see what happens to the astigmatism.
If it's you are going to do it and you're going to use like a Hoskin lens to, you know, to lyse them with an argon or green laser, you usually let them be for 2 months minimum, 3 months.
I think it depends on the case and how it went. I mean, if it's a typical M6 that you planned and everything went well and your incision was great, you don't really need stitches. But if you felt like, hey, I might as well just put them in because I'm here in the US and we've got sutures here and I've got the time, I'll put them in. And if they're astigmatically neutral, you really don't need to cut them ever.
Yeah.
Leave them. Yeah, you can leave them there forever. But if you do realize that after a month or so, there's 4 or 5 diopters of seemingly induced astigmatism, you could use a Hoskins lens and cut them. And I probably wouldn't do them, you know, if I put in 3 or something like that, I probably wouldn't do them all at once. I'd probably do 1 or 2 and see what happens.
Kind of stage it.
Yeah, I found that using that lens is a lot easier for the patients than digging through the conjunctiva, cutting through the conj with a needle or something, and then trying to cut that stitch.
Yeah, it's a good tip.
Well, you certainly get good at sclerotunnels with M6. So what other situations, you mentioned the value of sclerotunnels, what other situations are you using sclerotunnels for?
So yeah, that's been something that definitely has opened my eyes coming back to this country. You know, there were several situations I got in as a teacher at DMGI Institute. For whatever reason in Oklahoma, there was a lot of RK done there, RK followed by LASIK followed by more RK. So there, it was not uncommon to see people that had, you know, 20 or more incisions in their cornea. And now they need cataract surgery. And you're thinking to yourself, well, I mean, I make my temporal clear corneal incision and I got to do my phaco. And, you know, that's not always the best idea. As a faculty member, I had the opportunity to see several patients who had that technique done that the corneal incisions had just split open and the residents had put lots of sutures here and there to try to close them. They can be really difficult to close. So, you know, if you're in that situation, just think to yourself, well, what else could I do here? You just step back your incision a little bit, maybe make a little pruritomy, use some cautery to stop any bleeding, and then make a scleral incision versus that clear corneal incision. You'll avoid those RK wounds. Those RK incisions and avoid breaking those open and have a much easier case. Other instances, I mean, you know, you see people with peripheral corneal melts or peripheral corneal thinning, where you might think to yourself, well, I don't really want to go through the cornea here because it's really thinned out. Or in other situations where you might have pterygium in the way or something else in the way where you might want to just shift your incision architecture.
Yeah, I completely agree. For me, it's even PKs and other corneal surgeries. I want to avoid that cornea or, you know, bad ocular surface cases. If I want to minimize any incisions and induce a, you know, relative, you know, neurotrophic keratopathy in those areas. Are you suturing your sclerotunnels or how are you closing the conjunctiva?
So if you're doing an M6, you don't necessarily need to suture those. And to close the conj, what we do in Africa is we just use cautery. And I do them all superiorly. So the eyelid kind of helps put pressure on that conjunctival wound that you made. So you use a little cautery at the edge of that and then close the lid with a patch. And overnight, by the time you take the patch off in the morning, the conj usually looks pretty good. You can put a Vicryl in if you want or whatever suture you like. I typically use a 9-0 Vicryl because you don't have to take it out. It'll dissolve pretty quickly. And if it's a braided suture as opposed to a monofilament, people tend to be less irritated by it. Here, if I do a scleral incision or a scleral tunnel for that reason, for like RK or like you mentioned, avoiding a PK wound, I'll typically just take the conj down just a little bit in that area and make my incision, step it back just a millimeter or so. So not like a true M6 incision. And those, I don't really close the conj because I don't really feel like they need it. And then those tunnels usually don't need to be sutured either because they're still made with the same like 2-2 or 2-4 blade, whatever you're using.
That's great. And so, you know, this is a lot of good stuff for what we're looking on post-op. You know, is OD's doing any of the pre-op exams for you, besides, you know, dense cataracts, you know, really dense cataracts or, you know, significant RK where we're concerned about, you know, making another incision in the cornea or something like that. Is there anything preoperatively that OD should be looking for to kind of make the surgeon aware of, you know, to help you during the surgical aspect of the case?
I think that, you know, a couple of things have come up in my career at least, and those are really do have to do with positioning. And, you know, some patients we see have issues with their neck. They've had neck fusions and their chin is like attached to their, you know, their sternum almost, and can't position them appropriately. And trained as like a clear cornea temporal phaco surgeon, you're thinking to yourself, how am I going to get my legs under there? What am I going to do? How am I going to do this case? And to me, it's been really helpful to just know that, you know, we can go superiorly. Obviously, the guys before us did, and it's just something we never really trained on. But yeah, I mean, if you see a patient like that as an OD and you're doing the workup on them, you can think about this patient might be better to do superior phaco on, or, you know, if their cataract is really bad, or, you know, other things I've seen are people with severely loose zonules where the lens looks like it's about to fall. And, you know, do the retina guys in your area like to take care of that? Or does the anterior segment guy take care of that? And if it's us, if it's the anterior segment people, Are we going to do it via a large incision and do an intracap-based technique, which I've done a lot of? So unlike the case I described in residency where we really folded back half the cornea with sutures and used a cryoprobe, if you have a really loose lens, you can do the same M6 incision and just scoop the whole lens out, which I've had the opportunity to do in this country, but also plenty of times in Africa. So if you notice those things as a referring OD or as a co-managing OD, I mean, for sure, those are good things to know about as the surgeon and things that we can think about, like how do we change your technique to give this person a better outcome?
And then at that situation, if you take it out with intracap, you're going to suture a lens in or you're going to do an ACI well or something like that?
Either way, you know, there's been a lot of push in my career, at least, to move from ACI wells to scleral fixated lenses, initially with the scleral glue technique, and now more with intrascleral haptic fixation techniques and flange techniques. And I've done all those. And while I was in Oklahoma, we did a ton of that stuff. It seemed like we were doing, you know, several of those every week almost. And before I left, one of the residents looked at all of our postoperative data. And I presented this at a meeting and we saw that, you know, these people get CME, they get lens dislocations, they get all this other stuff that happens. These cases take a really long time. And one of the older doctors stood up who I really respect and he said, this is the same as the ACIOL data that we had from years ago, except you're not getting corneal edema, corneal decompensation, you're just getting lens dislocation. So the rate of complications is similar with ACIOLs and these scleral fixated techniques over time. They seem really cool. We as cornea specialists, of course, were taught, and most of us don't like ACIOLs because of corneal decompensation. But if done correctly and done in the right patient with a nice deep chamber and you have the appropriate size IOL, ACIOLs can do great. And typically, while in Africa, we use those, you know, just for lack of the ability to do automated vitrectomy and other techniques too, although I have done some Yamane technique there as well.
Yeah, I think being cornea, you do have a bias against that. You mentioned the value of a larger rexus size as well. You know, what is your typical capsule rexus size for your standard cataract, and when do you go for a larger rexus?
So yeah, in training, and typically, you know, with the optics that we have available today, we're taught to make our rexus, you know, about 5 millimeters, 5.5 millimeters, something like that. So you have decent coverage of the optic all around, which maybe happens or maybe doesn't happen depending upon how the case goes for you. And as a teacher, I think you learn a lot when you teach residents because you have the experience of sitting there watching other people struggle to some extent. But I think that, you know, watching people try to deal with tough cases or really dense cataracts and struggle almost as if they're stuck in a hole and end up breaking the capsule or just really having trouble getting the lens out, I realized that the rexus is really limiting us and the size of the rexus is really limiting us. And going to Africa and doing M6, you want the biggest rexus you can make. The first year I went there, I made the mistake of, you know, trying to make a continuous curvilinear capsule rexus a few times that was, it felt big to me, but it ended up being really small because you're trying to get this massive lens out through this opening. And oftentimes it gets stuck. So, you know, I got in the habit of either doing a can opener rexus, which is a great technique to know and a great technique to do, or just a really large capsule rexus, continuous curvilinear capsule rexus. And when I came back to the US, I talked to one of my good friends, one of my mentors who trained many years before me, and asked him what they did back in the days of extracap. And he said, oh yeah, we made a large rexus and spun the lens up and it was easy. But now that, you know, the IOL companies have kind of dictated the size of the optic and told us what size rexus we need, we've all shrunken down the rexus to 5.5 millimeters, which can really make your case more difficult. So for me, thinking about that more in this country, if I have a really dense cataract, specifically like a really dense brown one or one that's almost black, and I think that this thing's not going to crack well, I may change my technique and make that rexus just a bit larger, or as large as I want, actually, in some cases, so that I don't struggle, so that I'm less likely to create a complication to break the capsule, to drop the lens or something like that. So that, you know, if the lens doesn't come apart well, you can actually take the whole thing up and phaco it and deal with it that way rather than struggle in a hole and create a complication.
Well, you bring up an interesting point because, you know, I will agree that a lot of companies kind of tell you that you need to have a perfect femtosecond rexus to get the right effective lens position. Do you find that your refractive outcomes with these larger rexes are different or pretty much the same?
I think that they're pretty much the same. I mean, I was an early adopter of femtosecond cataract surgery, you know, years ago, and the data has kind of shown that it's not really necessary to make this perfect rexus. That, yeah, sure, effective lens position is definitely a real thing, but I think that there are other factors at play that are more than just your Rexa size. I worry more about my Rexa size with a square edge optic and exposing those square edges to the iris and potentially getting uveitis, glaucoma, hyphema syndrome with the iris rubbing or chafing on that lens. So if you're in that situation, there are different lenses you could use. Typically, in this country, we think more about using like a three-piece lens, you know, with a larger optic and a rounded optic and proline haptic so that you avoid those issues. But there are other lenses too. Bausch & Lomb makes a lens called the MI60, which I started using years ago. I was exposed to it while at DME Guidance too. These guys were doing 1/6 incisions or 1/8 incisions. And at that time, that was the only lens available to do that incision. And I started using it too, just to see what it was like. And it's more like a big rectangle, like a big plate haptic almost. And it's a great lens because you don't have anything exposed there for the iris to chafe against. So if you end up with a large Rexus or make a large Rexus on purpose, there are other lenses you can use other than three-piece. I mean, you know, a three-piece lens, one of the issues with that is you have to make a larger incision now. So if you're working through a 2.2, you have to enlarge that incision to a 2.75, and maybe you don't want to do that. A lot of techs are not used to loading three-piece lenses, and a lot of surgeons aren't used to loading them too. Even me, I've loaded plenty of them and put in plenty of them, and sometimes I forget, oh, what do I do with this leading haptic? Do I bend it? Do I not bend it? And then you end up breaking it or something like that, having to cut the lens out of the eye. So if you're using a lens like the MI60, that's a large rectangle that goes through a 1/8 incision, you don't have to alter anything. It goes through an injector just like we're used to. So, and I'm sure there are other options out there too that I'm just not aware of that will prevent any issues like that.
Well, that's awesome. And, you know, we really appreciate you being on the podcast, Dr. Cohen. I learned a lot from you tonight. You know, I wish you all the best on your upcoming mission trip. And you know, it sounds like your background really gave you a skill set that's pretty unique for not only helping the people in Africa, but the your patients in Arizona too. So with that, the last word is yours. If you have any other, you know, comments for our listeners or thoughts, please feel free. We're all ears.
Well, I'd like to thank you guys for having me on here. You know, I think it's been fun talking to you guys. You know, I think as a teacher, one of my favorite things to teach our residents was, you know, just don't be afraid to change your plan. You know, we're not cookbook surgeons. As much as we feel like it sometimes, we're doing the same thing over and over and over again. You don't always have to sit temporal. You don't always have to do the same incision. You don't always have to use the same IOL. You know, think back to your med school days and maybe your general surgery rotations where, you know, you just did things that seemed appropriate. And I think having that open mind has allowed me and some of the people that I've trained over the years to you know, do things that maybe they weren't comfortable with beforehand.
Yeah, well, those are great tips. Well, thank you again. And you know, don't forget to like and subscribe. And you can find all our episodes on YouTube and Spotify. And hope everybody has a good night. And until next time, thanks for watching.
The opinions expressed by the physicians in this podcast are solely the personal opinions of the providers and do not represent EyeCare Partners policy.